Welcome to the Kansas City Public Library. I'm Henry Fortunato, the Director of Public Affairs. And tonight it is our pleasure to welcome Mark Gardner, author of To Hell on a Fast Horse, courtesy of our good friends at Rainy Day Books. And as most of you are aware, To Hell on a Fast Horse is available for sale, and Mark will be signing copies after the presentation. Let's talk about today's presentation ever so briefly. I was thinking about it today. American history is redolent with dynamic duos. If you start thinking about it, Lewis and Clark, Bonnie and Clyde, Tippecanoe and Tyler Too, Barnum and Bailey, Masters and Johnson, Smith and Wesson, Abbott and Costello. I bring this up because To Hell on a Fast Horse and Mark Gardner point out that you know, you really can't have one without the other. You can't have Billy the Kid without Pat Garrett, and yet, oddly enough, To Hell on a Fast Horse is the first dual biography of this amazing and classic and quintessential American duo. And it is a fantastic narrative, and Mark is going to give you a wonderful presentation. Not only is he going to read from the book and talk a little bit about Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett, he's going to give you some musical entertainment in a sort of Old West kind of style. So, I mean, like, where else can you get this kind of stuff except the Kansas City Public Library? Tonight, we're here to talk about Billy the Kid, so please welcome Mark Gardner.
Thanks for coming, everybody. I was on the radio this morning, had a great chat with Steve on the NPR station here in Kansas City, and I'm actually originally from Missouri. I was born and raised in Missouri. I grew up in the little town of Breckenridge, which is between Cameron and Chillicothe. And my next book, I purposely chose because I wanted to get back to my Missouri roots. I wanted to get to the legend of Jesse James. So my next book is on the Northfield Raid, and I'm very excited about that. Spent 3 weeks up in Northfield last year researching, so I hope to get that out soon. But we want to talk about Billy the Kid, and I'm pretty excited about how the book is doing. It's actually the first printing is gone. But I think that what they have actually are part of the first printing, the first edition first printing. So what's coming out next will be the second printing. So if you're a book collector, these are the ones you want, what's in the stores right now. But anyway, so it's already into the second printing, so it's doing very well. And I think that says a lot about the fascination for outlaws in the American West. And there have been a lot of books on Billy the Kid, and there will be other books about Billy the Kid after mine. But I looked at Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett, as Henry mentioned earlier. But, you know, what I realize whenever I'm in interviews and whenever people review the book and whenever, you know, people ask questions, it always comes back to Billy. He always steals the show over Pat Garrett. And I kind of, the analogy I make is if you ever watch a movie about the gunfight at the OK Corral, you know, Doc Holliday always upstages Wyatt Earp. You know, Kirk Douglas was Doc Holliday. He steals the show. Dennis Quaid was Doc Holliday and Wyatt Earp. He steals the show from Kevin Costner. And Val Kilmer stole the show from Kurt Russell. It's, you know, those guys always take over. And so actually what I'm going to do tonight is a lot about Billy and music related to Billy, because that seems to be what fascinates people. And he's a fascinating person. And I hope in the book that he's a little more human, a little more real after reading it. But I want to start just by reading a short passage, and it's the very first two pages of the book. Ghost Stories. You can feel the ghosts as you speed down the long, lonely roads of eastern New Mexico. The land is little changed except for endless strands of wire fence and an occasional traffic sign. Out in the distance, they are there. Billy the Kid and the Regulators, Charlie Bowder, Tom Follard, and Pat Garrett. The days may be gone when blood flowed freely along the Pecos and Rio Bonito, but the music of the fandango and Billy's dancing and the lovers' kisses, all difficult to conjure, are all still there. They are in the wind, the moonlight, and the cacophony of coyotes, and in the silence before the first rays of sunlight spill over the horizon. And there are the stories, because New Mexico is full of stories. It is through these stories that the ghosts come to haunt us. In the stories, we think we see them, understand them, even somehow know them, but they are still ghosts, and they can conceal the truth like a pirate hides his plunder. Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett were perhaps the greatest of our Old West legends. By building on the output of previous scholars and conducting extensive original research in archival and private collections from Texas to Arizona to Utah to Colorado, I have made the ghosts give up a few more of their secrets. I personally explored most of the places that figure in this story: Las Vegas, Anton Chico, Fort Sumner, Puerto de Luna, Roswell, Lincoln, White Sands, White Oaks, Alameda, Arroyo, Mesilla, Silver City, and on and on. In some places, crowded Santa Fe, for example, the ghosts had been obliterated by asphalt noise and phony adobe facades. In others, such as the stairway of the old Lincoln Courthouse, Billy, Pat, Bob Olinger, and James Bell seemed to walk side by side up its creaking wooden steps. Many of the people connected with this story did not deserve their fate, Billy and Garrett most of all. They were like lovers, in a way, doomed, said Rudolph Wurlitzer, the screenwriter for Sam Peckinpah's classic film, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. They lived in a harsh land and time, a time that saw tremendous change while still retaining, in some instances, the cutthroat ways of its recent past. In the end, it was not as much about right versus wrong, lawman versus outlaw, as it was about survival. For others to survive, Billy could not, Garrett could not. These two men perished long ago, and that is the cold truth of history, but their ghosts are still there. Billy forever calls out to us from the darkness of the past. Quién es? Who is it? And like Garrett, sitting, waiting, we are unable to answer, unable to stop what happens next. Well, one of the things I tried to do in the book, I mean, it's a lot of it is Garrett's chase, his manhunt for Billy the Kid. But it's also about personalities. The two big personalities are Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett. But I also tried to get the personality of the times. And a great way to get at the personality of the times, I think, is through the music of the times. And it's hard to portray that in a book. And I do reference songs because Billy loved music and Pat Garrett loved music. But what I want to do tonight is some music that was familiar to Billy the Kid, Henry McCarty, Henry Antrim, Kid Antrim. He had lots of aliases. And also would have been familiar to Pat Garrett. And then do some songs at the end that have been written from the legend, songs written about Billy the Kid once he became an icon. As I said, I'm from Missouri originally, and I come out here every year to turkey hunt and to, I come out to visit. And when I was out here in September, I was actually on my way to Northfield and stopped here first. I bought this banjo at this antique mall on I-35. It only cost me $60. And then I spent $200 straightening the neck. And But it's made in the 1880s. It's not too far after Billy the Kid perished, but certainly Pat Garrett was alive when this banjo was made. It is a probably made by Lyon and Healy out of Chicago. It's got a leather head. Strings are Nile gut. That replicates the historic gut strings. No tone ring. It's very simple. But one of the things I do in my performances is I use the playing styles of the time and try to have vintage instruments because I want to be able to hear and my audience to hear the same kind of sounds that these historical figures would have heard. So it's kind of a time machine. And again, it helps evoke that personality of the time that I was talking about. When I think of Billy the Kid, initially when I began researching, and he was born Henry McCarty, probably on November 23rd, 1859, and we're not sure of that because there's lots of contradictory and debate over when he was actually born. Excuse me, but I think of him as being born of war. When he was born, we had all kinds of excitement and strife around Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, where John Brown conducted his raid, the idea of freeing the slaves and leading a slave revolt, and this caused quite an uproar in the country, and it just got worse from there. In 1861, Civil War breaks out, and Billy the Kid, as a young boy, grows up in that atmosphere. His father, and again, we aren't really sure who his father was. It may have been a man named Michael McCarty, and Michael McCarty died during the Civil War. And so Billy grew up in a family not unlike other families in that there was a single parent You know, mom was raising two boys, little Henry McCarty and his brother Joseph. His mom's name was Catherine. And they grew up for a while in Indianapolis. And they would have heard the martial music of the time, the brass bands playing the patriotic airs during that Civil War period. And that Civil War music remains some of America's most popular music for years and years after the war. And so I want to play one from 1862. Billy would have heard this song, may have danced this song. It was published in Chicago and written by a man named Henry Root. And it's called The Battle Cry of Freedom. Yes, we'll rally around the flag, boys, we'll rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will rally around the hillside, we'll gather from the plain, shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor and up with the star. While we rally around the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will welcome to our numbers the loyal, true, and brave, shouting the battle cry, freedom. And although he may be poor, he shall never be a slave, shouting the battle cry of freedom. The Union forever, hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor and up with the star. While we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. Thank you. Thank you. That playing style historically was known as stroke style, and I'm using the back of my index finger now and striking down and plucking up with my thumb. Today, banjo players pick with their fingers, and it's known as three-finger style or scrug style, but that's the historic style of the period of Billy the Kid and of the Civil War era. You know, Pat Garrett also experienced the war, but in the South. Pat Garrett's father was a Louisiana plantation owner, probably the most prominent planter in Louisiana. Pat was born almost 10 years before Billy. Pat was born in 1850. But the war ruined Pat Garrett's family, just like it may have ruined Billy's. The plantation was overrun by Federals. The cotton crop was confiscated, and Pat Garrett's father was ruined. And consequently, Pat himself, his life was ruined. His father died shortly after the war was over. He really went into depression, drinking. His mother died shortly after the war. So Pat Garrett strikes off for Texas. And in Texas, he becomes a buffalo hunter on the Staked Plains. He helps eliminate or exterminate the bison from the Staked Plains of Texas. And then Pat ends up in Fort Sumner, New Mexico, where we also have a young Billy the Kid at that time. Billy came to New Mexico in a more roundabout way than Pat Garrett. Billy, after his Indianapolis years, his mother had met another Civil War veteran named William Antrim. And they strike out for Wichita, Kansas, and they spend a short time in Wichita, Kansas. We know that Catherine McCarty is running a laundry there, but for some reason they all of a sudden pull up stakes, and they're in Denver, and then they're in Santa Fe, where Catherine marries William Antrim, and little Joseph McCarty and Henry McCarty are witnesses to the wedding. We know that from the marriage records there in Santa Fe, and they end up in Silver City. Now, all this jumping around, some people have theorized that they were moving around because of Catherine's health. She did suffer later from tuberculosis. In fact, she died of tuberculosis in Silver City. That may have been one reason. But also it may have been because William Antrim was a seeker of wealth, mineral riches, and he was an inveterate miner and a fortune seeker in Silver City. He was not around a lot to watch after his stepsons. And when Henry is 15, his mother passes away from tuberculosis, and he's pretty much on his own. He's already spent a lot of his life in the gambling halls and saloons of Silver City. He learns how to play poker and Spanish Monte. He learns the Spanish language fluently, New Mexican Spanish. He becomes New Mexicanized after a short time there. He gets into trouble, though, in Silver City. His first bit of trouble, he stole 5 pounds of butter from a local rancher. when I tell that to people today, they don't, well, what's the big deal, 5 pounds of butter? In a mining town, butter was $1 a pound, so that was $5. That was a lot of money for a rancher. The sheriff, Sheriff Harvey Whitehill, gave him a big talking to and thought he had gotten little Henry McCarty, or actually Henry Antrim by this time, thought he'd got him straightened out. That wasn't the case. Henry Antrim was always hanging around with the wrong people. And his next bit of trouble involved a Chinese laundry, and they stole materials, items that amounted to about $200, including a six gun and some clothing. And some of this stolen property turned up in the boarding house where Henry Antrim was living at the time. And the woman that ran the boarding house called Sheriff, sent for Sheriff Harvey Whitehill. And this time he decides he's going to really make a point, and he puts Henry Antrim in jail. Well, after a few days, Henry Antrim asked to see Sheriff Whitehill, and he complains. He says, you know, the jailers keep me in this little cell. I'm not getting any exercise, and I'd like to get out and, you know, stretch my legs, exercise a bit. He felt like he was being picked on. So Sheriff Whitehill tells the jailer, let little Henry out into the hallway where he can stretch a little bit. One day while Sheriff is gone, he comes back, and there's no Henry Antrim. He's completely out of the jail building. And there was a laborer working outside the building. He asked the laborer, did you see anybody come out of the jail? He said, I didn't see anybody come out of the door, but there was a kid that came out of that chimney up there. And that's what Henry Antrim had done. He'd scrambled up through that chimney. And, of course, Henry Antrim thinks he's a wanted man. He had been arrested, put in jail. So he actually flees New Mexico territory, goes to Arizona territory. And, again, he's always hanging out with the wrong folks, starts stealing cavalry horses and gets into other trouble. And then at Camp Grant, Arizona, he kills his first man. And it was really one of those things where he could have gotten off in a court of law that would probably have been a ruled self-defense. But what happens is there's a blacksmith there at Camp Grant, a civilian blacksmith known as Windy Cahill, because he liked to boast and tell tall tales. He was also a bully, and he picked on Henry Antrim, who was now called the Kid, sometimes Kid Antrim or just the Kid. One day he picked on him just too much, and Kid Antrim had a pistol. And he starts to pull out his pistol. The blacksmith sees it, and they struggle over the pistol. And Henry Antrim, Kid Antrim, shoots Windy Cahill. It's not a fatal wound immediately, but it is a mortal wound. And Henry knows that the blacksmith is dead, and he flees because, you know, murder is a hanging offense. If he had stuck around, he probably could have gotten off, but he didn't want to take that chance. So he flees back to New Mexico and becomes involved in what's called the Lincoln County War, which is really a feud between two rival economic factions in this huge county, Lincoln County, some 30,000 square miles. It was the largest county in the United States at that time. And he gets lost in the Lincoln County War, but he's quickly discovered because he becomes a main player. He fights for one side, the side of John Henry Tunstall and Alexander McSween. They were fighting against the House, which was the opposition. When John Henry Tunstall is murdered by a sheriff's posse, Billy vows revenge, and he gets it several times. One of the things about Henry McCarty, Henry Antrim, and he becomes Billy the Kid, when he gets to New Mexico territory, he comes up with this name that we don't really know where it came from. He comes up with William H. Bonney. Some people have theorized that, well, maybe Bonney was his real father, and that's where he got it. We just don't know for sure. But because he goes by William H. Bonney, we start getting the Billy part. And eventually, within the last 6 months of his life, the newspapers are calling him Billy the Kid. He loved to dance. Again, he spoke fluent New Mexican Spanish. And this next little piece I want to do ties in with two things. The way Billy had adapted to his environment, but also the type of music that he liked for the bailes and the fandangos of Hispanic New Mexico. Billy would tell the fiddlers at these bailes, and he was said to have been a beautiful dancer and a singer, but he would tell the fiddlers, don't forget the gallina. And he meant a particular tune. Now, in English, gallina means chicken or hen, but that's not what it means in New Mexico. If you speak New Mexican Spanish, you know that gallina means the wild turkey. It's gallina de la tierra is the full phrase, meaning the chicken of the region, la tierra, the chicken of the earth, la tierra. If you meant a chicken like we know as a chicken, you would say gallina de Castilla, which is the chicken of Castile, Spain, which is the area around Madrid. So when he said, don't forget the gallina, he was telling the fiddlers, don't forget to play Turkey in the Straw.
Thank you.
Turk in the straw, turk in the hay. Bullfrog dance with his mother-in-law. Play a little tune called Turk in the Straw, Turk in the Straw, Turk in the Hay. Bullfrog dance with his mother-in-law. Play a little tune called Turk in the Straw. Thank you. Well, Billy, again, we know that he loved music, and there were particular songs he liked. One of the songs that's been handed down to us time and again that he apparently liked to whistle, and he whistled it so much that he became obnoxious with this song. It was first published in 1873. It sold 2 million copies in the 19th century, another 1 million copies in 1907 when it was revived. I hope my book does that well. Anyway, it was called Silver Threads Among the Gold. How many people have heard of Silver Threads? Yeah. It was so popular, you could understand. I mean, it had a very catchy melody, so I can see how Billy would get hooked on this song. What I think is ironic about that, though, is that, you know, this is a song about growing old together, and Billy dies at the age of 21. I'll do a couple of verses from Silver Threads Among the Gold. Darling, I am growing old. Silver threads among the gold shine upon my brow today. Life is fading fast away, but my darling, you will be always young and fair to me. Yes, my darling, you will be always young and fair to me. Darling, I am growing old. Silver threads among the gold shine upon my brow today. Life is fading fast away. Thank you. I talk about in the book the circumstances that Billy fell into through the Lincoln County War. He ended up fighting on the side that lost. He was indicted for murdering Sheriff William Brady, who was killed during the war. Billy wasn't the only one that had a hand in that, but he was one of the few that were indicted. I think there were three others beside him that were indicted for that murder. So he has a really much more serious murder charge than killing a blacksmith in Arizona. He's helped kill a duly elected county sheriff of Lincoln County. He had an opportunity to get a pardon from the territorial governor, Lew Wallace. Anybody heard of Lew Wallace before? Yeah. He wrote Ben-Hur, the best-selling novel of the 19th century, probably the first part of the 20th century. Billy agreed to testify in court for a murder charge against some of the people involved in the Lincoln County War in exchange for this pardon. Billy did his part. For whatever reason, Governor Wallace did not fulfill his part of the bargain. He did not issue a pardon for Billy the Kid. So Billy leaves Lincoln County and goes to San Miguel County area, which is present-day Fort Sumner, Dabaca County, New Mexico. He steals horses and cattle, robs an occasional stagecoach. In fact, he hangs out with a gang that's very adept at moving stolen animals between Texas and New Mexico, and there are ready buyers for the stolen livestock on both sides of the line. And the cattlemen are getting fed up, the law-abiding citizens in New Mexico Territory are getting fed up, and they elect Pat Garrett to be sheriff in November of 1880. And Pat Garrett doesn't wait around to fulfill his promise of putting an end to that gang. He wouldn't officially become sheriff until January 1st, but after he's elected in November, the county sheriff, who wants nothing to do with Billy the Kid, hands it over to Pat Garrett, makes him a deputy sheriff, and says, go for it. And Pat Garrett organizes posses, and within a few weeks' time, he actually tracks down the Kid's gang near Fort Sumner and captures the famous Billy the Kid in December of 1880. Later, I have a whole chapter about Billy's escape after Pat Garrett had captured him, after Billy is convicted of this crime of murdering Sheriff Brady. And I'll let you read that about the famous escape, and also about Pat Garrett's killing of Billy the Kid in Fort Sumner on July 14th, 1881. I have a chapter called The Darkened Room, which goes into great detail about how that happened. What I want to do, though, is talk or at least do some songs about the legend, because what I feel about this, what I say in the book, basically, Pat Garrett had to kill Billy the Kid for Billy to become the iconic legend that we have today. If somehow Pat Garrett had captured Billy a second time and Billy had been executed, I don't think he would really be the legend that we have now. Pat Garrett had to kill him. And Pat Garrett wouldn't exist as a lawman, a famous lawman, had he not done that job. And that killing of Billy the Kid had a dramatic impact on Pat Garrett's later life, which I'll talk about more here in a minute. But I think, yeah, let me get my guitar. Billy was killed on July 14th, 1881, and it made national headlines. Pat Garrett was the hero of the hour. He got all kinds of reward money. People were literally throwing money at him. I mean, not just the territory's reward money, but people were donating money to Pat Garrett because they were thankful for what he had done by eliminating this outlaw, Billy the Kid. And there were always the stories and newspaper articles over the years about Billy the Kid. I mean, he was one of the notorious Western outlaws. But it wasn't until a book appeared in 1926 that Billy made this great leap in legendary to really a pop culture figure. And that book was called The Saga of Billy the Kid by Walter Noble Burns. He was a Chicago newspaper man. And I'm sure they have that book here even in the library, and I can highly recommend it because it's a fun book to read. Walter Noble Burns interviewed lots of old-timers in Lincoln County about the Kid and Pat Garrett. But that book was a tremendous bestseller. In 1926 was the birth of the Book of the Month Club. And that was like the first main selection of the Book of the Month Club. It was a huge bestseller. Well, there was a recording artist at that time. I should say not an artist, a recording scout. He worked for a record company. And he read that book, and he thought that would make a great song. So he sent Walter Noble Burns' book to a composer known as Blind Andy Jenkins. Blind Andy Jenkins is what we call a hillbilly performer, a recorder. And he told Blind Andy, you know, I think that this would make a great song. And I care, apparently Blind Andy was not completely blind if he could read this book. So anyway, and he had a helper too. So the song was called Billy the Kid, and it was recorded in 1927 by a very popular star at that time named Vernon Dalhart. Any audiophiles will recognize Vernon Dalhart's name. And it's been recorded since by all kinds of people. Marty Robbins did a version of this in 1959. Ry Cooter has recorded a version of this song. I'm going to perform it for you on this guitar, which I've only had since December. This is a Gibson tenor guitar. It was manufactured about 1928, so it was brand new when that song was popular. A tenor guitar only has four strings. In the 1920s, the tenor banjo was dropping in popularity, but the guitar was rising dramatically. There were all these tenor banjo players that would love to play the guitar. So they made a guitar that had the same tuning as a tenor banjo, so it's the same fingering. And I'm a banjo player, so that's why I have a tenor guitar myself. So this is Billy the Kid by Blind Andy Jenkins. I'll sing you a true song of Billy the Kid. I'll sing of the desperate deeds that he did. Way out in New Mexico, long, long ago, where a man's only chance was an old 44. When Billy the Kid was a very young lad, out in Silver City he went to the bad. Way out in New Mexico with a gun in his hand, at the age of 12 years he killed his first man. Fair Mexican maidens play guitars and sing a song about Billy, their boy bandit king. How ere his young manhood had reached its sad end, had a notch on his pistol for 21 men. On the very same night when poor Billy had died, he said to his friends, I am not satisfied. There were 21 men I have put bullets through, and Sheriff Pat Garrett must make 22. Now this is how Billy the Kid met his fate. The bright moon was shining, the hour was late. Shot down by Pat Garrett, who once was his friend, the young outlaw's life had now come to its end. Down in Pecos Valley, all covered with green, out in Hell's Half Acre, three graves can be seen, where Tommy and Charlie and Billy now lie. Their trail of blood ended, they all had to die. There's many a young man with face fine and fair who starts out in life with a chance to be square. But just like poor Billy, he wanders astray and loses his life in the very same way. Thank you. It's really amazing how the story of Billy the Kid has inspired so many writers. There's tons after Walter Noble Burns, including Mark Lee Gardner. I was inspired by that story. The films in the movie industry, over 60 films have been made with Billy the Kid as a character in the film. And it's inspired singers and songwriters like Blind Andy Jenkins. I have some favorites of the more modern or contemporary songs. And I guess my favorite Billy song was actually written by Bob Dylan. You may recall in 1973 there was a Sam Peckinpah film called Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Now, I really love that movie. It's my favorite Billy the Kid movie. It really evokes, I think, it was evocative of New Mexico in the 19th century. It was filmed in Old Mexico. It has a lot of the myths. Billy and Pat Garrett were not friends, and I talk about that in the book. But still, as I said earlier today on the radio, you know, Billy exists in a different world in cinema, and he exists in a different world in novels. And that doesn't bother me if a picture has an inaccuracy or an anachronism. I like seeing how that story is interpreted over and over again in its variations. But Bob Dylan wrote the soundtrack for Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, and he wrote some songs. One was a huge hit, Knocking on Heaven's Door. You probably heard that. That was from the movie. But I'm going to do the song you don't hear as much, and it's just called Billy. There's guns across the river aiming at you. Lawman on your trail, he'd like to catch you. Bounty hunters, too, they'd like to get you. Billy, they don't like you to be so free. Camping out all night on the veranda, dealing cards till dawn in the hacienda. Up to boot hell they'd like to send you. Billy, don't you turn your back on me. Playing around with some sweet señorita, into her dark hallway she will lead ya, to the shadows of the mesa she will greet ya. Billy, you're so far away from home. They say that Pat Garrett's got your number, so sleep with one eye open when you wonder if every little sound just might be thunder, thunder from the barrel of his gun, thunder from the barrel of his gun. Billy, they don't like you to be so free. Thank you. Well, I'm going to do two more songs because I want to leave some time for questions, and I always like to answer questions about Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett. And I spent a lot of time with Pat Garrett after Billy was killed. Pat Garrett lived for another 27 years, and he lived under the shadow of Billy the Kid most of that time. One of the tragedies of Pat Garrett's life is that he was a hero immediately after he killed Billy the Kid, but as Billy's legend grew and Billy became the romantic hero, the Robin Hood of the Southwest, well, there had to be a villain to that story. And Pat Garrett, the sheriff, who had risked his life for many of the citizens of the territory, became the villain in his own lifetime. And he had to deal with all kinds of rumors and innuendos and scuttlebutt about, well, you know, did Billy have a gun when you killed him? And were you hiding behind a couch when you killed Billy? And Garrett said, if there had been a couch there, you bet I would have been hiding behind it. He had killed two of my guards. There's no way he's going to take a shot at me. So, one of the legends, and this again, this came out just literally over just about a week after Billy was killed at Fort Sumner. The Las Vegas Daily Optic ran a story, and it said they had in their offices a jar filled with alcohol, and within that jar was a finger, the trigger finger of Billy the Kid. They later ran a story saying not only did they have the finger, but they had the entire corpse, which had been dug up and placed in a corral, buried in a corral in Las Vegas so it would decompose, and they were going to reassemble the skeleton. And they really made hay out of this story over the weeks, and at that time, newspapers were very gullible, and papers got subscriptions to each other's papers, and they would run these, you know, interesting tidbits or stories. So this story went all over the country about the finger of Billy the Kid on display in Las Vegas. And it may seem hard to believe now that people would be so gullible, but you have to remember, this was in an era when it was really popular to take body parts of dead outlaws and display them. I mean, the whole body sometimes. Big Nose George was an outlaw up in Wyoming. When he was killed, a local doctor had his skin tanned and then made into shoes and a satchel. has everybody had their supper? I hope so. The Northfield Raid. I'm working on the Northfield Raid. It's my next book. Not only were those bodies displayed publicly and photographed, but then, you know, an ear was cut off and saved as a souvenir, and they still have the ear at the Northfield Historical Society. So, you know, in the 19th century, those trophies, those body part trophies, were fairly common. So you can see why people would believe, well, yeah, you know, let's go see the trigger finger there at the newspaper office. The paper said that they had such a large crowd, they were thinking about constructing a tent outside the building to accommodate all the people that wanted to see Billy's trigger finger. There was a young lady from California that read the article in California, and she wrote the paper saying that she was Billy's sweetheart and she would really like that finger. But they said by then they'd already sold it to Chicago for $150, and where it was on display. Pat Garrett actually was upset by this story, and he made a special trip to Fort Sumner, according to a Fort Sumner resident named Charlie Four, who was there at that time. And he said both he and Pat went out to the cemetery, and they determined that the grave had not been disturbed. So, you know, Pat was concerned, and he wanted to make sure that no one had really had desecrated the cemetery and dug up Billy. And when Pat brought out his own book about Billy the Kid in 1882, he said, "I know for a fact of what I speak, and that his grave has not been touched." Despite all that, despite Pat's denials of what had happened, I mean, the story was a hoax, but it has persisted in legend and rumor and in history books. In 1920, a book came out, The History of Billy the Kid, by Charlie Siringo, who's actually a member of one of the posses that was after the Kid in New Mexico Territory. He said not only did Pat Garrett go to Fort Sumner, but he said Pat actually dug up the body himself to make sure the finger was still there. And I don't think that happened. But in that movie I refer to, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, the Sam Peckinpah film, if you watch that, and I encourage you to check it out from the library, at the end of the film, there's a scene where one of Garrett's deputies, after Billy is killed, he runs up and he grabs Chris Christopherson's hand, who's playing Billy the Kid, and he has a knife. "I want the finger of Billy the Kid." And Pat Garrett, who's James Coburn, kicks Poe off the body and yells, and he doesn't want him to touch. So that has persisted throughout time. I'm going to do a song for you now called The Finger of Billy the Kid. Now, that started out as a poem. It was written by Phil Lenore, who was a cowboy poet. He'd actually gone to New Mexico as a health seeker in the teens. He died in 1923 in Las Vegas. But he wrote this poem called The Finger of Billy the Kid because he was fascinated by that story. And like a lot of poems, they end up becoming songs. And in this particular case, I wrote the melody for the poems to make it a song. So I said, I would love to perform this as a song. So you're going to get to hear tonight The Finger of Billy the Kid. Oh, that finger of Billy the Kid, what a heap of harm it did. But when Billy died, the finger died too, and was buried beneath the morning dew. No more to pull his six-gun true, the finger of Billy the Kid. But one day up Chicago way, I heard a sideshow fellers say, "Just step this way and for a dime you'll see the trigger finger of Kid Billy, what has pulled 100 massacres, the finger of Billy the Kid." Well, I knew that feller, he lied like a snake, and that his finger was a fake. But I paid my dime to see the show, for I was a friend of Billy's. I'll have you know, he did me a favor in New Mexico. The outlaw Billy the Kid. I followed the crowd into the hall, saw the finger preserved in alcohol. Then I pulled my gun so none could tell, and I blowed that thing clear into hell, and gave a yip and a mighty yell. Hurrah for Billy the Kid. Of course they threw me into jail, from where a letter I did mail to Sheriff Pat Garrett, who killed the kid. And I told him what I'd gone and did, and to tell me quick if he'd got rid of the finger of Billy the Kid. Well, old Pat came back quick and hot, and in a few words he said a lot. The trigger finger of young Billy is still upon his dead body. I know, because I dug to see the finger of Billy the Kid. If Billy can hear from his 'dobe shack, I reckon he knows I paid him back for the favor he did me when my voice was stilled by thirst and hunger, and my body he filled with buffalo meat that had been killed by the finger of Billy the Kid. Thank you. Well, I really hope you like my book. I want to thank everyone for coming, and I am going to take questions here after this last song. I also want to thank Rainy Day Books and the Kansas City Public Library Plaza Branch. I wish I could see this backdrop behind me. This last song I'm going to do, I'm going to leave you a teaser for my next book about Jesse James and the Younger Gang and the Northfield Raid. This is a song called Cole Younger. And Cole Younger, of course, was captured along with his brothers after the Northfield Raid of 1876, September of that year. And this song was written by someone in the 1880s. It was a hugely popular cowboy song. And this version was actually collected in New Mexico by a ballad collector known as Jack Thorpe. Jack Thorpe published the very first book of cowboy songs in 1908 in a town of Estancia, New Mexico. And the ironic thing, or I guess the interesting thing about Jack Thorpe was that he collected all these great songs that cowboys were singing, but he didn't publish them unless they were songs about cowboys. It had to be about the range or cattle. And so Jack Thorpe, he wrote about how cowboys were singing Jesse James and Cole Younger, and we know those are very popular, but he didn't publish those in his book, but he did keep a notebook, and that's where I got the words to Cole Younger. And it was, like I say, it was hugely popular with the cowboys. So I'm going to leave you with Cole Younger. It tells a little bit of the story of the Northfield Raid. And again, thanks for coming, and I'll take questions here just when we're done with getting rid of Cole Younger. I am a noted highwayman, Cole Younger is my name. My many depredations have brought my friends to shame. The robbery of the Northfield Bank, the crime I can't deny, for which I am a prisoner in Stillwater Jail, I lie. There was a California miner, the truth now I will tell, who had $30,000, his name was Brigham Pell. I robbed him of his money, and I sent him on his way, for which I will be sorry until my dying day. We started out together, when Brother Bob did say, we will buy some pretty fast horses on which to ride away. We will ride and avenge our father's death and strive to win some prize. Fight those anti-guerrillas until the day we die. Then we started for old Texas, that good old Lone Star State, but on the Nebraska prairies, the James boys we didn't meet. with guns, knives, and revolvers. We all sat down to play, drinking of good liquor, boys, to pass the time away. The Union Pacific Lightning Express was the first one we surprised. The remembrance of that bloody deed brings tears unto my eyes. Engineer and fireman were killed, the conductor escaped alive. We left their bodies moldering beneath Nebraska's sky. Next we started northward, yes, northward we did go, to that godforsaken country called Minnesota. Everybody in Missouri loves that line, yeah. My eyes were on the Northfield Bank when Brother Bob did say, Cole, if you undertake that job, you're sure to rue the day. We stationed out our pickets and to the bank did go, and there upon the counter I made my fatal blow, saying, hand out your money, and that without delay. We are the noted younger band and have not long to stay. I am a noted highwayman, Cole Younger is my name. My many depredations have brought my friends to shame. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so are we taking questions, Henry, then?
That was absolutely great.
Oh, thank you. Oh, right, this gentleman right back here.
What was the population makeup of Lincoln County, and what was the size of your two characters?
Very good question. Let me answer I'll take an order. If I remember correctly, Lincoln County in the census had around 1,000 citizens, but tens of thousands of cattle. Tens of thousands, but about 1,000. And I have the statistic in the book, but that's what I'm thinking. The height. Billy's been described between about 5'8", between 5'6", 5'8", in his height. Pat Garrett was 6'4". He's extremely tall. Pat Garrett was so tall, I love this story. When he came off the plains, the state plains, as a buffalo hunter, they described his clothing. And the bottoms of his trousers were made out of buffalo hide, because on the frontier, they don't have factory-made clothes for somebody that's 6'4" tall. So he had to sew on leggings so he would have pants that were long enough for him to wear. When he was killed, he was murdered in 1908, and I have a whole chapter on his murder there in Las Cruces. And it's quite a controversial episode in the story of Pat Garrett. But they had to supposedly delay his burial to order a coffin from El Paso that was large enough for him to fit in. So he was a huge man, literally. Yeah.
You referred previously to the myth of friendship between Pat and Billy. How much do you think this myth contributed to the rise of the, the survivalist literature, people like Rushing Bill Roberts and somebody else whose name lived me, who pretended that they were, in fact, the survivors?
Yeah, the question was about the myth of Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett being friends, and how much that myth contributed to these pretenders, these people like Brushy Bill Roberts that claimed to have survived. And I think that it did contribute a lot, because if they are friends, then it explains why someone could say that Pat Garrett and Billy were in cahoots. And some accounts claim that Pat Garrett was in cahoots with Billy just to collect the reward money and let his friend Billy escape. That myth was a very powerful thing in promoting those legends of those survivors or those tales of the Billy imposters. I have to say, and I mentioned this on the radio this morning, that I would have loved to have written that story about these guys being best friends, because the drama and the tragedy is so rich there. But it just wasn't the case. I couldn't support that. And I even had found a document or an interview where Pat Garrett told a close friend in White Oaks that, Billy minds his business, I mind mine. We aren't friends, and we're acquaintances, and that's as far as it goes. Yeah.
I read one biography where they gambled enough together, where one was called Big Casino
No, it's, well, that's in the John Wayne movie. What he's referring to actually comes from that Walter Noble Burns book, and it comes from Paulita Maxwell, who was Billy's girlfriend. And according to Paulita Maxwell, Pat Garrett was known as Big Casino, and Billy was known as Little Casino. So that legend of them being friends has some grounding in earlier literature. I don't believe the Paulita Maxwell story myself, and I think that old-timers at Fort Sumner, and this is a theory of mine, like to promote that myth because it made Pat Garrett the bad guy by killing his best friend. And you'll see that repeated, the Big Casino, Little Casino, but I don't really have that in my book.
Now, on the one you're writing now, mm-hmm. it's told that Genghis was the nickname used for Jesse James by his friends.
Genghis, is that true?
Yeah.
Okay. Haven't gotten to that part yet, but they say it's true, so... how about right here?
What about the women in their lives?
The women in their lives. We could spend hours talking about the women in the lives. Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Not quantity, but okay. But what was that? Somebody. Okay. Oh, you can't hear? What she's asking about, she wants to know about the women that are connected with Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett. Pat Garrett married a woman initially named Juanita Martinez. And she died on the wedding night. And then after a few months, he married Apolinaria Gutierrez. And she was known as Apolinaria, and that was kind of anglicized to be Pauline. And they spent decades together, and it was a very, you know, loving relationship. I'll tell you a quick story about their relationship. Of course, Apolinaria was a native New Mexican. And Pat Garrett, like Billy the Kid, learned how to speak New Mexican Spanish. One day, Pat Garrett made the mistake of teasing his wife about her English. She never spoke English again for the rest of her life to Pat. She might speak it with the kids, but Pat Garrett never got English, and so he always had to speak to her in Spanish. So she was just as stubborn a person he would. Now, as far as Billy's, he's been linked with many different women, or young girls, I should say, in New Mexico. He had charisma, charm, personality. He was always smiling, laughing. Everybody loved Billy the Kid in New Mexico, at least the ones that were close to him. You know, if you were an enemy or you were getting shot at, you didn't like Billy. But the girls loved Billy the Kid. The one that apparently led to his demise, her name was Paulita Maxwell, when she was the sister of Pete Maxwell, who was the owner there at Fort Sumner. And Billy hung around at Fort Sumner, even though he was, you know, wanted by Pat Garrett and by the law. He hung out there because of his sweetheart, and that's how Pat Garrett caught up to him. If he had fled to Mexico, he might have lived a lot longer, but love kept him in New Mexico, and that's how Pat Garrett got him in the end. Oh, okay, yeah, let me answer that real quick. She asked if either one had children. Pat Garrett ended up having 8 children with Apolinaria, and they came in 2 different bunches, and so he called them his first and second crops. And they dearly loved their father, Pat Garrett. And I've seen letters. I've actually got to hold and keep in my house a packet of letters written by Pat Garrett's children to Pat Garrett. And a collector loaned them to me. And they're just wonderful letters because you can just tell how much they love their father, how much they respect him. He struggled mightily to maintain that family. And one of his daughters became blind at a very young age, and he had to send her to a special school, a blind school in Texas. That daughter grew up to become a very well-known composer. Her name was Elizabeth Garrett, and she wrote the New Mexico state song, "O Fair New Mexico." So that's written by the daughter, Pat Garrett. Billy has been rumored to have lots of offspring, and we don't really know for sure without some kind of DNA testing whether they are or not. One man I met who had a very convincing story, he's from Santa Rosa, New Mexico. His name is Elbert Garcia, and the story was that his grandmother or great-grandmother, Abrana Garcia, was Billy's sweetheart, and she had children, and that had always been handed down in the family. Independently, I found an interview from the 1940s with a Fort Sumner area ranching family, and they say, oh, we all knew around Fort Sumner that Patrocinio Garcia was Billy's son. There's been DNA evidence collected that's blood of Billy the Kid, and maybe it's possibility of matching that at some future date. But there's lots of connections with Billy, and I don't doubt that he has offspring in New Mexico to this day. We just can't prove for sure. Now, this person way back there had something, yeah. Yes.
Is that the same Charlie Ford or the family double shot Jesse?
No, and I probably mispronounced it. It's actually F-O-O-R, four, as opposed to F-O-R-D. Yeah, well, that's all right. So it's Charlie Four, and so no connection to the Ford family.
And second question,
Who's what?
Ear.
Oh, it's I don't know which one it is. It's I think it's like Charlie Pitt. Is it Charlie Pitt's ear?
Charlie Pitt's or Clone Miller.
Okay. And I have to say, when I was up there and I talked with the director, and he personally does not feel that that ear is legit. I mean, it's a human ear, but he has questions of whether it's the actual ear that came from one of the robbers. And I don't know how you would tell, again, unless you did DNA. Yeah.
I understand your new book on the Northfield, Minnesota raid is a work in progress.
Yes.
Well,
what I would like to do, and the same question was asked by people when I did the Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett story, and he wants to know what new am I going to bring to the story of the Northfield Raid. I really pride myself on digging deep and finding new sources, fresh sources. And I can say I spent 3 weeks in Minnesota last year. I came back with 600 pages Xerox from contemporary newspapers, and I felt like those newspaper accounts have not been used as dramatically as they can. And the same thing was with the Billy the Kid, Pat Garrett story. There were interviews, newspaper accounts that had not been brought out, as well as I think that they could have been. And I want to tell the story, really focus on the raid itself and the manhunt. It was the largest manhunt up until that time. There were 1,000 men in the field. And I really hope to make it like this, an action-packed, thrilling narrative, starting with the raid and following that manhunt and what happens. And what really intrigues me the most, and I hope I can elaborate on this, is the fact that somehow Frank and Jesse escaped. And we still debate exactly how they did it, what route did they take. And I think there's some stuff to be mined there as well, at least from what I was looking at while I was up there. The Defeat of Jesse James Days.
Yes, and I have a good friend from Northfield who kids me about that all the time. And I said, oh, well, then I guess you guys captured him, huh?
That's right. Well, I think it's, they made away with just a little over $20 and change from that raid. But that town has reaped millions since then off of that. They get like 100,000 people for that. I was there in September for that. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. What I enjoyed about being there was the sense of scale when they reenact it. I mean, sure, there's thousands of people watching, but when you see a horse and rider in front of the original bank, that street shrinks a lot when you're watching it. So we've got two more, a couple more? You've been wanting to ask a question.
The title of the book, To Hell on a Fast Horse, how did you come up with that title?
Okay, well, that's a good question. He wants to know, how did I come up with the title for the book? I was trying to think of a title that would not only capture people's attention, but really summed up how violent New Mexico Territory was in the 1870s and early 80s. People didn't have, if you were a gunman or you were involved in a feud, your lifespan was not very long. I mean, Billy the Kid dies at age 21. Sheriff William Brady, the sheriff, is murdered in the streets of Lincoln. And I started just thinking of phrases, and I just thought, to hell on a fast horse. Actually, my first title was Riding to Hell on a Fast Horse. And then my agent said, I think let's just go with To Hell on a Fast Horse. So that's kind of how that, I just came up with imagery that I thought represented the violence and the murder and the death, the carnage that was going on, unlike any other place in the country. I mean, it was, the mortality rate in Lincoln County was very, very high in the 1870s, just because, I mean, from gun, you die from being killed by other gunmen. So one more question. How about way back there, that gentleman there? Okay, in the song, you heard him say, he killed a man for each year of his life, 21 men. He did not kill that many. It's up for debate exactly how many, because the thing is that Billy killed men single-handedly, but he also killed men with his cohorts. So if you look at the men he killed for sure by himself, it ends up being four or five. So we have Wendy Cahill, who I mentioned earlier. We have a gambler, Joe Grant, who shows up at Fort Sumner, and Billy kills him single-handedly. We have the two guards that Billy killed in order for him to escape in April of 1881 from the jail. The other questionable that could bring it up to five, and I go with the five figure because I believe that Billy is the one that delivered the mortal wound to Buckshot Roberts, or Andrew Roberts, at the gunfight at Blazer's Mill. And I think that was in 1878. So I think it's possibly five. But then there's all these others that he had help with. Sheriff William Brady, there was people, we don't know, was it Billy's bullet? Was it Billy's bullet and somebody else's bullet? There's other episodes which could bring it higher, but it's not single-handedly. I think that four is a lot for anybody. So, but it wasn't 21. Okay, is that it, Henry? If people want to ask, we'll do a couple more. Yes. Okay. How about this lady way in the back? How did my fascination with these individuals begin, is what she asked. I was really more interested in Pat Garrett. My original idea was to do a book on Pat Garrett because I felt like he's kind of this stick figure, this one-dimensional. I mean, there's all kinds of Billy the Kid books, and you're lucky to get a page about Pat Garrett in those books. There was a biography done over 30 years ago, and it was an excellent biography by Leon Metz, an El Paso historian. But I thought, you know, that Pat Garrett story I thought was really rich. But when I approached my agent, I said, you know, I think Pat Garrett would be a good idea for a book. He said, it's got to be a dual biography. You got to do Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett together. So that's how that book idea came about. Now, I've always been fascinated by the American West. And when I was a kid, my family, we took summer vacations to forts and museums. My parents loved history. They're both here tonight in the audience. I think that's always been around since I was a kid. And this gentleman right there. You know, I wants to know, where does the myth that Billy the Kid was slow or somehow mentally incapable, that was the genius of Billy the Kid. And I write this in the book. He had this talent for making people underestimate him. That was his deadly skill. He looked like somebody. He was happy-go-lucky. He laughed. People didn't take him seriously. They thought, how could this guy be a killer? And when you underestimated Billy the Kid, you usually ended up dead. And that's how I think a big part of his escape from the Lincoln County Jail in 1881, these guards that he had underestimated his cunning, his willingness to do deadly, evil things in order to gain his freedom. And so that's, I think, where that a lot of that comes about. I mean, that was part of his own doing. I mean, it's easier to fool somebody if they don't think you're smart. But he was extremely intelligent. Yes, this young lady right here. She wants to know if Pat Garrett's book, The Authentic Life of Billy the Kid, published in March of 1882, was a bestseller. No, it was not. It was published and distributed by the Santa Fe New Mexican in New Mexico Territory. So they didn't have a good connections. You know, they didn't have the publicist like I have with HarperCollins, you know, that's pushing this book all over the country. They just have the money or the talent to really promote the book. And, you know, Pat Garrett I think his ghostwriter, Ash Upson, they had grand ideas that this book was going to do well because, you know, this was the era of the nickel novel, and people were making tons of money off of outlaw books, but it just didn't happen. And that's a very, very collectible. They didn't print large quantities. That book can sell for $20,000 if you find a first edition. It was in paperback. I know a collector in Santa Fe who has three copies, but each one is different. And you know, different color cover. You know, he actually has one that was bound in leather, which apparently a few were bound in leather for Pat Garrett, and it's signed by the author. So it's a very, very rare book and highly desirable. So if you find a copy, give me a call. And yeah.
Billy's brother.
Yes, Joseph. He wants to know what happened to Billy's brother, Joseph McCarty. Joseph McCarty grows to adulthood. He becomes a gambler. He's a faro dealer. He works at different saloons and gambling halls around the West, in Pueblo, Trinidad. He's in Denver. He supposedly was in Chicago, maybe even Kansas City. He traveled around as a faro dealer. He lives till 1930. I think that's the year he died. In 1930, a few months before he dies, he's interviewed by the Denver Post, a Denver Post staff writer. And the Denver Post writer is really interested in his gambling career. He asks not one single question about his brother. And it's a full-page article, no question about his brother. And apparently, the reporter didn't know he was the brother of Billy the Kid. So, missed opportunity. And then, what I always like to think about with Joseph McCarty, Joseph Antrim later. He lived to see Walter Noble Burns' book, this huge bestseller about his brother. He lived to see the King Vidor movie, Billy the Kid, based on the book. Did he go see it? You know, I mean, what did he think about this, how his brother that he had known in New Mexico, how did he become this amazing icon? And nobody ever talked to him about it, or at least that we know of, and it was published. The man right behind you had a question. Yes.
Well, I was down to his grave last year.
Okay.
And I was asking people around, where is Stinking Spring?
Hmm.
And nobody knew.
Okay. Stinking Spring is where Pat Garrett captures Billy, the kid, in December of 1880. It's 15 miles east of Fort Sumner. And and I actually went to the site. It's on private property, but I went to the site and the stone building that they were holed up in, where Pat Garrett surrounded them. The foundation can still be seen on the ground. The stones from the foundation. The stones, I guess, were taken and used for other buildings later. But it's 15 miles east of present day Fort Sumner, New Mexico.
Okay. All right, this is great.
Thank you.